Welcome, guys. I think we all know each other, but glad you guys could join. So we don't need to do introductions because you guys certainly know each other and you know us by this point. So we only have two things on our agenda today, and if it's okay, I'm going to reverse the order of the agenda just because our colleague Matt Mullen was going to present on the active transportation. So I'm gonna start diving into the roundabout stuff. So let me share my screen real quick. And okay. Oh shoot. Sorry, guys. I had opened it before, so it wasn't on the so it was on the desktop app, and there we go. Okay. So, not sure if you guys saw in the meeting packets, but AMATS has just completed a draft roundabout study. So this is our first study of this type. Years ago, Dave Pillay from our office did do kind of a crash analysis of the roundabouts that we had at that time, where we compared crashes pre and post building a roundabout. But this is the first, what I'd call a more comprehensive study of roundabouts. And so wanted to just hit a few of the high points on it, and then certainly we can talk about any questions you have. But kind of three main sections to the plan. The first part is really just sort of a broad level overview of kind of the basics of roundabouts, where they work, where they don't work, pros, cons, why you'd put them here, why you'd build a single lane versus a double lane, what they look like in rural versus urban locations, things like that. Just the
Matt,
basics of roundabouts. Yeah.
sorry, I hate to interrupt. At least on my screen, I'm seeing all done. You can close this file now, and we're not seeing slide changes if you are changing the slides. So I just
Oh,
want to
weird.
give you a heads up.
No, thanks. So let me try sharing the screen again, and hopefully it works better the second time. Okay, can you see a full screen now? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, great. Cool.
Nice.
Okay, so yeah, that's the first chapter of our plan. It's just very general. It's not specific to our area, but it's just kind of a basic education of roundabouts. But then we get into the fun stuff, and now my slides aren't advancing. So I'm having all sorts of issues tonight, guys. I'm sorry. There we go. So the next chapter, we start discussing specifically what do we have in the AMATS region. And the centerpiece of this is looking at our 28 existing roundabouts that are on our collector and arterial routes. But we also list and describe other categories you can see here, like our planned roundabouts, things we have funded, or the traffic circles we have, like the Talmadge Circle or those kinds of things. And so we inventory all of those, and just here's a map that Seth designed for us that just kind of lays those all out. Not all of these things on the map are roundabouts. Some of these are traffic circles, like the TC, the orange color, but different categories just showing where all of these are. We also made note of our neighboring roundabouts. They're not on this map, but those that are outside our planning area but near our borders, just to try to be thorough on every type of circular intersection we have within or near our region. But then going back to those 28 roundabouts, what we did is we kind of took a deeper dive with those with, high quality aerial photographs before and after, some roundabout characteristics, and then we get into a crash analysis on a lot of our roundabouts. So we have the 28, 17 of those we were able to do a crash analysis for. The ones you see in the chart in the upper right here, the reason we couldn't do that, those is because those are our newer roundabouts. We just don't have enough post data to really do a comparison. We had a couple different methodologies we used based on how old or new the roundabout was. And what we did was a couple things we ignored the years of construction, which, for obvious reasons, because things are going to be very different then. And we also skipped the year after the roundabout was built, just the idea being that people are still getting used to that roundabout and conditions may not be typical yet. And then we, just tallied our crashes based on the data we had, by their level of seriousness. And so, take this with a few grains of salt, but this is basically kind of our list of, or our table showing kind of how each roundabout performed, the 17 that were part of our analysis. And here they're ranked in their overall order, overall crash reduction or increase from kind of best performing to not as good performing. And you can see here, what we're really looking at with roundabouts, and often the reason that roundabouts are built, is we're trying to reduce our more serious crashes. And fortunately, we found that 15 out of 17 of our roundabouts reduce, had a reduction in injury-related crashes. PDO stands for property damage only, so that would be a less severe crash where, two cars crash into each other, car crashes into a tree, whatever, things like that. There it was about half and half, which is actually probably a little bit better than I think some of us would have expected. We saw 9 out of 17 improve. Our overall crash rates, it was also 9 out of 17. Although I will note that some of the ones that did have a crash increase, it was pretty modest, 3%, 6%. So overall, it kind of supported what we hoped or maybe expected it would. We hear all the time that roundabouts are done to improve safety, to reduce the more serious crashes. And the data, at least that we were able to collect, definitely supports that.
And Matt, if you could go back real quick, I
Yeah.
apologize. I just want to jump in just because I think it's also interesting to note, like you can see in Twinsburg, the Darrell Road 91 Ethan Drive, a lot of times, it's where you had no fatalities before the intersection or a serious injury before the roundabout was built, but then you have them afterwards. But I believe in the case with these, a lot of times what we're seeing too is like drunk driver crashes that aren't necessarily, true because of the roundabout, but happening because the person was drunk and blew over the roundabout, basically crashed their car through the roundabout or things like that. So I think when Matt says, some of the data to take with a grain of salt, it's not really until you get down into the crash level or the crash report details where you really see what's happening. So sometimes these numbers can be a little misleading, where you could be like, oh man, there's so many more, these horrible injuries happening. And that might not have anything to do with the actual roundabout. It's just where it happened.
No, I'm glad you said that, Curtis. That's a great point. Yeah, and that's exactly what I meant by, first of all, these data sets, for as much data as we had to analyze, a crash here or a crash there can real especially with a more serious crash where they're not as common, that can really change your numbers. So you really do have to dive into almost individual crash reports. It was kind of fun and interesting, as we were finishing this up and just checking our data and stuff, we saw a lot of interesting things that just made us pause and like, okay, what's this really telling us? And but we wanted to at least give kind of a snapshot of what we're seeing, at least with the somewhat limited data we have. And then our last chapter, and you guys, if you haven't already, you might be interested to check this out on our website. Chapter 4 of our plan, it was kind of interesting to compile this. It's a much more qualitative chapter, but this is based on conversations that we've had with many of our communities that have built roundabouts, in recent years. And then just kind of the stuff we've heard through the grapevine from previous conversations with our communities or things we've observed in the office. So this is kind of, we compiled this sort of as almost like a best practice guide for, our local governments. If you're planning around about and thinking about whether that might be the right option or how do I even do this. There are just a lot of ideas discussed in this. It's not a long chapter, but ideas discussed here that just kind of give some, guide rail type best practices. And some of them, like some of them could be a little bit controversial to some, like we have heard and we believe pretty strongly, like, don't overbuild. Engineers love to overbuild and make roads wider, or hey, we might have too much growth, so we should design this extra slip lane here and stuff. And people justify these huge growth rates, but what we see is that our traffic volumes are going way down, and in even in some of our growing communities, so just things like that. So we just lay those sorts of ideas out for our communities and readers of the report to consider. And then the last section of chapter four, it's really more a guidebook, just so we can, so people that are considering building a roundabout can understand the different funding sources that exist and, know where to go to learn more and what the project amount limits are, when to apply, all that kind of stuff. So, that's the plan in a nutshell. But I'm curious what of any questions you guys might have. Okay, so all sounds like none.
Well, I
Oh,
think Ron had his hand up, and
sorry, I couldn't see. I still had
hand
my
out Bill. Maybe
presentation
you
up, so
can
I
say
couldn't see that.
something at
Yeah,
some
Ron.
point. Not a question so much, just a comment. I just spent the month of April in The Villages, Florida.
Yeah.
It's a planned retirement community with 100,000 people. It's maybe 30, 40 miles long, north to south, and 3 or 4 miles wide, and they have two boulevards. Two main boulevards going down north to south, and they have roundabouts every half mile or so. So I'm guessing they might have 50, 60 roundabouts in this planned community, and they work extremely well. It's four lanes intersecting two lanes, so two lanes coming in and going around. And once you get the hang of it, it just moves traffic so smoothly. You just barely have to slow down at intersections. And then when you do come to an intersection with another major road that doesn't have a roundabout, you get a red light, you're going to be sitting there 5, 6 minutes. I mean, it's painful.
Yeah.
So I'm a big fan. I'm surprised to hear Summit County has 28. I didn't realize there was that many around.
Yeah, and
If
I
you ever
can't
get a chance to
remember. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
if you ever get a chance to go there, you ought to just go check it out and see how well it works.
Yeah. No, I'm familiar with the community. I know that's becoming a pretty popular place. I didn't know that they had a lot of roundabouts, but I will definitely be checking that out on doing like a Google image search to see what you're
Yeah.
talking about.
Okay.
So, any other questions?
One question that I had.
Comment.
Sorry. Go ahead, William.
Well, I was looking at that roundabout with the tire worker there. I don't know, trying to boost the appeal of Akron slash Summit County. To where people would know where you're at when you say, well, it's at the tire worker roundabout. And I'm thinking of the Akron Fulton Airport with its roundabout with a big statue in the middle of a Zeppelin, because we made them back in the 30s there in the air dock. So a combination of city pride, artwork. You don't want to block the view of the people coming into the roundabout and who's across from you and coming from your left and right. But I don't know. It's an idea maybe for traffic, but maybe more for the from the county art council. Don't we have something like that promoting art in the area?
Yeah, and so we did in chapter four, where we were kind of laying out best practices and lessons learned and stuff, one of them was that, you know, and this is in national, you know, guidance and data too, that like roundabouts are a great opportunity for placemaking, for like making the community special, or, you know, and that the rubber worker one is the most iconic example, I think, within our region. But there are other examples where like pretty cool things are done with landscaping or, you know, just other signage and stuff. So yeah, we, you know, and I guess the inverse side of that is that, you know, if a place isn't maintained or the weeds aren't weeded and stuff like that, it can really make a place look abandoned. I think one of my original drafts had stronger language in about that, but we softened that up a little bit.
Well, I want to thank everyone that worked on that study. It was very interesting reading through the history of roundabouts. Having been stationed in Europe, of course, traffic's a little different, but
yeah,
it's an excellent traffic management system to put these in.
Yeah. I mean, they are an effective solution in a lot of places. And there's a lot that goes into the decision of whether that's the right solution at an intersection improvement, but the data is hard to ignore, you know, just like the national data, you know, the statistics. So yeah, thank you.
I'll tell my insurance company we're putting these in, and maybe they'll lower my car insurance rate.
Austin, you had a question too?
Yeah, and it's possible this was in the report. I'll admit I haven't had a chance to review it yet, but this discussion has piqued my interest. For roundabouts where there's bike lanes that are, you know, just outside of the roundabout, what is the standard practice for that? Or maybe it depends on the exact situation. How does the bike traffic merge into the roundabout traffic?
There are different ways that can be done. And I want to say it was the city of Green. One of their engineers had given us feedback, and it's in chapter four of our report, but like they mentioned an idea of, I'm not going to do it justice trying to describe it, 'cause I can't remember exactly what it is, but there are ways to kind of like merge a bike lane into it. And they have found success with the idea of like bikers dismounting and doing it that way. I don't know that there's a standard practice. I've seen all sorts of different things. Most of our roundabouts do not have bicycle lanes, but there are plenty that do. I can't give you a good answer, but
and I think the practice that I feel like I've seen the most of typically has been examples of where the bike lane will actually sort of phase into the ADA crosswalk or the ADA cross ramp and encourage bicyclists to cross at the legs versus getting in the, like you're allowed to use the circle if you wish. But I think the predominant thought is to try to encourage them to cross further down the neck where it's a little bit safer, because too, I think just bicyclists especially are more susceptible to those side swipes that could happen in a roundabout when people don't know exactly what they're doing in a car that might make it. So I think, but I've also heard they really want to have both. You know, the idea is that you can do both. You can become a pedestrian or you can stay as a bicyclist on the road. But as Matt said, I don't think there's not yet been that one thing that, say, Federal Highway or anyone's come down and said, this is the absolute best way to do it.
And I think what you just described, Curtis, is very similar to what Paul from Green told. You know, it's kind of like channelizing the bicycles so that they're entering and exiting at the crosswalk points, I believe. But I couldn't tell you how many of our roundabouts are designed that way versus, you know, that I just don't know.
I'll make another comment from my experience of the villages. I did do some group rides with a bike club down there, and they're very cautious about roundabouts. And I think their strategy is they say take a lane, and they actually take the outer lane of the roundabout so that cars aren't tempted to squeeze by them as they move through the roundabout. And you know, traffic has to slow down for a roundabout. It's not a terrible inconvenience. It'll still make people mad, I'm sure, but hold them up a little bit while you go through the roundabout and then go back over to the edge of the road and let them go past.
Yeah, I would think in a group ride setting, that's always the preferred, you know, is to take the lane, because you've got sort of a, you know, it's sort of like, what's the example of like the fish, the school of fish kind of thing. Like,
yeah.
It's, you know, I think, but for the solo rider, I'm guessing it's probably a little safer to not do that. You know, or I don't know. I just think about what I'd want to do. And I think if I was by myself, I'd probably want to use the crosswalks. But if I was in a group, I'd want to take the road.
And I'll bet there's some. Oh, go ahead, Bill. Sorry.
So this goes back 10 years to my commuting days to downtown Cleveland with several people from the Sherwin-Williams company. So you all may not be familiar with 14th Street, which until they connected the towpath all the way up around Tremont, in the morning we would come up a hill, and there's a roundabout there, but you know, you didn't have to take the roundabout on the way into work, because the bike lane ends right there, and we would just get on 14th Street. There is a bike lane on 14th on both sides and take it into downtown. But coming home, you had two choices. You could either cross at a crosswalk and get back on the trail and go down the hill on the bike trail, or do what me and one other crazy guy did, and exactly what Ron was talking about. We would take the lane. We'd start in the right lane and then move over. And because we had to make a hard left around the roundabout. And I would say I never really felt like there were any kind of close calls. I mean, if you signal and let people know that you're going into that roundabout, you can do it pretty safely. So.
Yeah. And like someone said earlier, you're going by design, you're going relatively slowly. Doesn't mean bad things couldn't and probably would happen at some point, but at least speeds are pretty low.
The one benefit to that particular roundabout is that you only have to deal with people in three different directions, the people behind you and the people on the two sides, because it basically ends there. There's, you know, there's the highway on the other side, and that's down below. So it was a little bit easier of a roundabout, but you still have to deal with people coming across at you.
Yeah.
A lot of fun.
Any other questions? Okay. Well, if not, Matt, can I call on you to
yes.
Talk about the active transportation plan?
Yes. Sorry, I was a little late.
No, I not just, a problem.
Yeah, I just I just sent the link to the active transportation draft in the chat. So if it's on our website now and.
Yeah, and I have that queued up on our website, at least. So if you need me to do a screen share, like if we want to look at anything, I can do
that. Afterwards, if we got any questions or anything. But just so people don't, I'm sure you all know, but active transportation is defined as human-powered mobility, such as walking, biking, or rolling, which examples is wheelchairs and these electric scooters that we have. In our area. So the Active Transportation Plan, or ATP, it looks to highlight what has been accomplished within the region and to identify additional recommendations for improving the active transportation network. Just as a reminder, the ATP is an input document for the next long-range transportation plan that we are working on. So the process that is involved in January, committee members were asked to assist in updating a map of future shared use path recommendations. In March, these draft recommendations were made available to the public for comment. That period closed on March 24th. along with strategies and goals. These draft recommendations were approved in March by the policy committee for inclusion in the final active transportation plan. Earlier this afternoon, the Technical Advisory Committee, TAC, approved the draft version and sent the plan for full approval to the policy board next Thursday. So the final draft of the 2024 active transportation plan has been placed on the AMS website. Sorry, we just mentioned that. It includes 11 chapters of information along with a shared use path map that highlights existing, planned, and recommended shared use paths along with the existing bike lanes. The plan also features a goals and strategies matrix that highlights different approaches municipalities and organizations can take to improve the active transportation network. That's kind of our brief update here. If anybody has any questions.
Well, and if you don't mind, I'll just mention real quick, we talked about this in May or March also. And I know Austin and I think Bill, you gave some, we had, yes. You know, several citizens throughout the region that provided comments on our draft map. And what I think it's Appendix C, Matt, is the one where we show all those comments we received and kind of mm-hmm. how we responded to them. I know I talked with you directly, Austin, a couple times back and forth with emails, but I did end up following up with, you know, all the, you know, Summit Metro Parks, Cuyahoga Falls, Akron and stuff. And once we got everything totally finalized, we added some of the, where we could, we added those suggestions to our recommended alignments, and where they were deemed not feasible, you know, we noted why not at this time. So a lot of yeah. cool stuff to check out, but I know you guys got to look at the good stuff back in March, but.
Actually just received a comment the other day. So we're kind of, it's past the comment period, but we're obviously still always taking comments from the public. So if you forget, you know, or if you have a new comment, obviously feel free to contact us, send us an email.
So any questions about the active transportation plan?
Okay. I see a chapter 11 conclusion. Can you summarize the conclusion?
I don't remember what the conclusion said. I'll be totally honest.
It's a short chapter.
Yeah, I think it was really just kind of, a summary of where we are, where we're headed. You know, I would guess it probably reiterated that, you know, we support building up this network. There are a lot of different ways to do it. Our map and list highlights where we, you know, what we hope to tackle next and how we hope to tackle it.
Yeah. And I think in the overall scheme of things, you know, this list of projects will probably have to be whittled down in order to get on our long range plan. Just from we have, and I probably explained this before, for those of you that don't know, we have fiscal constraints. That means that, you know, we show a certain amount of budget projected through 2050. And so we can only spend so much money without going over budget for that planning. And so a lot of times, you know, part of the work in the next year will be identifying, you know, which of those which of those routes will be ones that we prioritize and put in the plan. And the good news is that for those that aren't in the plan, they're still eligible for funding, but you get more points in our funding policy if it's in the plan. So, you know, we will be looking to our CIC and task force and our metro parks, all to provide feedback and say, hey, these are really the ones we think that we can do here in the next 5, 6, 7 years. So that's kind of, you know, this gives us the broadest map, and then we're going to have to whittle it down. Hopefully not too much, but there probably will be some pieces of trail that don't make it on the long range plan.
Understood.
Okay, well, that's all we had. Well, I will say one quick plug before we go to open discussion. If you're not already aware, AMATS does have a bike and brainstorm this Saturday in Hudson. So if anybody is interested in that and you don't have the information on it, let us know. We'll make sure you get the flyer and everything. But I know some of you guys are up in that part of the county and are certainly active bicyclists. So if you don't have anything better to do on Saturday morning at 10, Matt?
Yep.
Is that when it starts?
Yep.
Be sure to come on by. But yeah.
I know Mike Hulver from Task Force has already registered for the Bike and Brainstorm.
Okay.
I think he is going to participate in the actual ride. I'm actually going to stay back at the library and participate in the other session.
Okay. Yeah, and so, and Matt, you can speak the details better than I can, but I think they're keeping it open, kind of having like an open house while we're doing the ride, but the mm-hmm. brainstorm itself, you know, people can do both, you know, but like they're also having the library open. And folks from the city of Hudson planning are going to be, you know, there to answer questions and explain, because Hudson has so much going on with their active transportation network. Did I say that accurately, Matt?
Yeah. We'll be in the community. We'll be in that community room. And then Phyllis from AMATS will be there.
That's right. Yeah.
During the ride. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So sounds like we'll see you there, Bill.
Yep.
Great. Are there any other questions or topics you'd like to discuss while we're all here? That's all we had for our formal agenda. Okay.
Going once, going twice, three all times. Right, wait, wait, wait. No!
I've been out of town for a long time, and I'm just getting back into things. When I left, Metro RTA had said that they had their appraisal of their rail properties completed, and they needed to get it appraisal of the appraisal done. I don't know what the status of that is, but in a conversation that I had with Gert Wilms and maybe Tasha Eric. Harris, they were talking about we might be able to get a copy of the appraisals. Has AMATS heard any communication or seen any results of the appraisals that were done on the rail properties?
I have not. So in fact, even since the last time I think we spoke at the last CIC, you know, they did hire a new planning director, Nate Lepo, who I think formerly of Stowe, Bill.
Yes,
you're
so Nate now has that position.
Yep. And yeah. He was at our technical advisory committee meeting today. But I think he's just getting his feet, you know, just getting his feet under him. I think he started a few weeks ago. But I think he'll eventually kind of be running, running as part of that process. But I don't know, Matt, Matt Mullen, if you've heard anything else, because I have not heard since we talked last. I haven't heard anything about the appraisals.
I have not heard anything about the appraisal. That's the they're in the FTA is reviewing the appraisals. And then that should be the final step. And then the final step will be them making the decision over what best suits them, but
the ball is in FTA's court though. Yes. Pretty much. Yeah.
So you think the appraisal was completed?
I don't know. That's what I'm saying. I don't know if it's completed, but I think they're still in the process of it. If I were to guess. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I guess we might have better news next week, because we're meeting with Nate next week. So
yeah.
Oh good. I'll just add as I was leaving that meeting, I walked out with Gert Wilms, and we were talking about several things. And she mentioned that Valerie's position was going to be filled by Nate. And I asked if then Nate would have responsibility for rails. And Gert's comment was, her understanding was that Tasha was going to keep the rail portion of the responsibilities.
Oh, okay. Least, that makes sense. Yeah.
Maybe initially.
Yeah.
That's informal, but it's a comment that that I heard.
Yeah. That's good for us to know too. Like I said, we're meeting with Nate next week and, you know, still kind of, they've got a lot of new people, obviously, still trying to figure out how those responsibilities shake out.
Yeah.
Great.
All right.
Hey, everyone. Well, if there are no further questions, enjoy the rainy evening, and hopefully we'll see you back in August at our next CIC.
Yes,
and enjoy and your Bill, summer. We'll see you this weekend at the Bike and Brainstorm.